From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a look at the lasting effects of exposure to the harmful chemicals known as PFAS. Then, when a company puts its name on a public venue, there's much more than a name on the line.
What is at stake for a company, the kind of calculations that they make, are not just what they get in terms of marketing, but also various side deals.
Plus, UWM philosophy professor Mark Peterson joins us to talk about the intersection of mythology, philosophy, and world religions found in Star Wars.
What it means to be good is to fulfill yourself as a human being and to live a completely authentic life. And so the hero's journey maps, in a case of like Luke's trajectory, right? These are psychological obstacles we all come to as we travel towards our own authentic lives.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A group of man-made chemicals called PFAS is attracting attention around the country. Last week in Washington, the House passed a bill that would take steps to regulate these chemicals that are found in everything from waterproof materials to firefighting foam. Research has found that they can be harmful, especially to children. Wisconsin's PFAS Action Council meets for the second time today to try and come up with strategies to minimize the impact of PFAS. WUWM's Susan Bentz spoke with Swedish researcher Carl Gustav Bornehag. He's a professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Karlstad University. He led a recently published study that followed more than 1,500 infants whose moms had low levels of PFAS. Dr. Bornehag begins by explaining how the study was designed.
So when the pregnant women came to the midwife for the first time, we took samples. And they filled in questionnaires, and we interviewed them. And the samples we took for this purpose was blood from the mother in week 10 of pregnancy. And this was done for more than 2,000 pregnant women. The blood samples were analyzed for the content of 8 perfluorinated compounds. And out of these 8, 5 of them were found in almost all mothers.
So there's so many PFAS. How did you decide which 8 to focus on?
Well, that is a good question. Today we know about hundreds of perfluorinated compounds in the environment. These analyses were made in 2010 around, and that the old one, PFOA and PFOS, they have been analyzed for quite a long time, and we added on a number there. But this is very much related to the chemical analysis we can do. And at this time, there were not very many labs that did more than this. But today, we can analyze many more of them.
You started off at week 10, and then what happened then beyond that point?
Yes, we followed these families. Of these more than 2,300 mothers, we measured the exposure in around 1,950 of them did get a child, gave born to a child. In this specific study, we then had the birth outcome in terms of birth weight, birth length, the gestational week for birth, also other outcomes related to the birth. The overall idea was to examine if the exposure for these kind of chemicals in early pregnancy was related to the birth weight in any way.
So were these moms from around the country or in one specific area of Sweden? And is that significant whether it was or was not from throughout the country?
This is from one county in Sweden, and Sweden is not very dense. So in this county, we have roughly around 275,000 individuals, and around 2,500 kids are born every year. So we invited from the beginning all pregnant women. However, around 40% of them accepted to participating in the study. So it took us a little bit more than 2 years to get the cohort of more than 2,000 mothers to follow. But this is, I mean, perfluorinated compounds have been focused on both, as we are doing here, the general population, but it's also a matter of people that are related to industries that are producing and using these chemicals in the production phase, where the exposure is much, much higher. So we have no industrial exposures. We have not contaminated water, for example, of these compounds. So this is typical low exposure population.
Your findings were troubling, of course, and you saw a difference between boys and girls.
We looked for the association between the exposure in early pregnancy and birth weight, as I said. And we did see an association between higher exposure in early pregnancy and a lower birth weight. And this is following the literature here. There are around 10 studies out there, even more, that have been showing this typical association, a lower birth weight related to exposure in early pregnancy. What we did find here was also that the association was stronger for girls than in boys. And this is not very easy to give an answer why in an observation study as this is, an epidemiological study. But we suspect that there might be endocrine disruption mechanisms involved in this association. And the biological mechanism here could be something about endocrine disruption. And if that is true, then we can really expect different effects in boys and girls. But as I said, a study like this can only find out the associations, and we can see here that there are different effects in boys and girls. But the reason why here is not really the focus of such a study. We can't answer that question. But for very many chemicals, also that we have been studying, for example, phthalates and phenols and other kind of chemicals, it's a typical pattern that we see different effects in different sexes, which may have something to do with sexual hormones, for example, or other hormones.
The PFAS that you did focus in on through the study, where are those chemicals present in the environment?
These kind of chemicals. The reason why we have been focusing on these chemicals for quite a long time is not from the very beginning on health effects. It's more about the environmental effects, because they are so extremely persistent.
Meaning that once it's there, you can't get rid of it. Yeah.
No. Very many of the compounds we have been focusing on and others, they are metabolized in our bodies. So if you take them, if you get them into your body, they are metabolized and you get rid of them in hours or days or something. But these kind of chemicals, and these chemicals act as PCB and DDT, you know, the compounds we banned almost 40 years ago, but we can still find them in newborn babies. They are persistent, but these kind of chemicals are even more persistent. And I know chemists that tell that maybe we will never get rid of them because of their persistence. And that means also that they are bioaccumulating in humans, for example. And that is the first problem here. So when they are used in products and come into the general environment, so to say, they will be there for very, very long time. So it means that the exposure goes on and goes on. And it also means that even if you ban them and don't use them in different products, they will still be in the environment and expose us. And today we really don't have a good idea how to get rid of these compounds. I mean, if you take a parallel with plastics and plasticizers in soft PVC, for example, if we could get rid of the plasticizers in all products that we are using, then people would be free from exposure in days. But that is not the case for these compounds. That is the first very, very big concern about these compounds. But coming to the sources where they are used. I mean, these are water and grease repellent. So they are used for many, many aspects. They are used in food packages. They are used in raincoats. They are used in cooking ware. They are used in a number of different products. One of the disasters we have had in Sweden is that they have been used in firefighting foams used by military people when they, and they have been training for years with this, and contaminated groundwater, which. And we have such areas in Sweden where we have such exposure. And compared to the study we have been doing, people in such areas can be 100 times higher exposed because they have it in the water. But so for human uptake, if we talk about sources in that respect, very much of the uptake is coming through food items. And fish consumption is one of the major sources for human uptake.
So has Sweden established stringent regulations, and how are they tending to that firefighting foam issue when it gets into groundwater?
Yeah, I mean, we have stopped using that kind of firefighting foams for sure, but the problem is that the contaminations are there, and we have today no straightforward way to get clean up this area, which is, of course, is a very, very high concern. I mean, this is drinking water from the ground. In Sweden, we really have good drinking water, and we have had that for a very long time. But these things that have happened with the firefighting foam is really a bad story. And here we have the circumstance that is rather remarkable, that some of these compounds were taken away by the industry before the legal system did any banning of these compounds, which is rather remarkable. But today there are, both in the US and in Europe, PFOS and PFOA is on the way out. But as we started talking about, it was that there are very many of these compounds in the environment already today. We talk about hundreds of them, and some of them can also transform. It could be an original compound, but then it is transformed in the environment to another one. So this is really an environmental problem that we currently don't have a good way to handle.
So push for policy.
I mean, that is the way to go here. And what we need is more brave politicians or authorities that really nail this question and say, we have to get rid. This is not only a matter of humans. This is a matter of the entire environment. They are everywhere. What I should say here is also that we have published quite recently another paper focusing on the same exposure, but the outcome in that case was preeclampsia among the mothers. And what we could see there was that there was a strong association. The higher level of several of these PFAS compounds the mother had in her blood, the higher risk for preeclampsia. And we should remember that preeclampsia is an issue and a concern for the mother's health. We know that that is something we try to avoid. But preeclampsia is also a matter for the fetus. So that is adding evidence. I mean, this could tell us something about the mechanism, why the kids are impacted by this exposure. And in a coming paper, we are going to look on miscarriage. And I think this is really a number of papers that will focus on the importance and the danger by exposing very early in life, because it's something completely different to expose an adult person, adult healthy person, than a fetus under fast development.
So, in other words, if a child, a girl, is exposed at a young age from prenatal on and ultimately becomes pregnant, that could signal significant difficulties.
Absolutely. And there are so many aspects here that we haven't discussed, but we also know that if you have a pregnant woman that are exposed, we should remember that we are, in reality, are exposing three generations. We are exposing the mother, for sure. If these compounds are passing placenta, then we are exposing the fetus. And for many of these compounds we are talking about here, we know that they pass placenta. But in the fetus, we also have the germ cells, so we can expect that we have effects downstream, meaning that the effect can be even in the next generation, which is really telling us something. I mean, we have always thought about it's just what we are exposed at the moment that make us sick. Then we have started to understand that maybe exposure during fetal status, fetal development will mean something for that kid. But now we also start to understand that we are exposing even further generations downstream, which make this question even bigger.
Carl Gustav Bornehag is a professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Karlstad University. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz, and she'll continue to follow how Wisconsin is dealing with PFAS in the coming weeks. Coming up next, if you've ever looked up at the stars and wondered, how was Pfizer able to slap its name on the Bucks Arena? Well, this next segment is for you. We learn how companies get naming rights for spaces here in Milwaukee when Like Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Just about every public venue in Milwaukee is named after a company. The Brewers play at Miller Stadium, soon to be the American Family Insurance Stadium. The Bucks play at Pfizer Forum. And now the Wisconsin Center is hoping to get in on the game with a new push to sell its naming rights. All of these spaces are publicly owned or operated. So why and how does a company get to put its name on one of these spaces? Larry Sandler wrote about the practice of naming rights in an article featured in Milwaukee Magazine last summer. Sandler spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in July, and he starts by explaining what these deals entail.
What is at stake for a company, the kind of calculations that they make, are not just what they get in terms of marketing, but also various side deals. And this is something that a professor I talked to from UW-Parkside pointed out, is that, for example, if you're a beer company like Miller, there may be connections to pouring your beer at the venue. Or if you're in some other kind of business, there may be some opportunities to use that venue for your events, such as your hiring events or your client events. There may be opportunities to do other deals with the team that are completely unrelated, or there may even be opportunities to make connections with other sponsors because there might be meetings or events where they have all of the sponsors together and then you get to do some other side deals.
Now, who makes the deals with whom? So are these deals generally made with the team or whoever owns the building?
Well, that varies depending on who owns the building. So if, for example, you're talking about the Wisconsin Center buildings, then those are generally made with the venue owner. Now, in some cases, the venue owners have agreed to give the team the naming rights, and this was the case with the Brewers Stadium, which is now Miller Park and won't be for much longer, and also with the Bucks Stadium, Bucks Arena, I should say, which is now Pfizer Forum. In both of those cases, the state legislation did allow the team to get the revenue from the naming rights.
Which I think is really confusing for people. You know, you really focused on publicly owned buildings, which a lot of people associate with, well, my tax dollars are going to either building that space or maintaining that space. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. There are public dollars that are going to building and maintaining the spaces in both cases, both the case of the baseball stadium and the basketball arena. However, in both of those cases, there also are private contributions. And so you could think of the naming rights revenue as offsetting the private contribution, you know, particularly in the case of the Bucks Arena, where the Bucks and the former owner, Senator Cole, put in a fairly significant amount of the dollars. And so the naming rights were for them a way of getting back some of the money that they put in.
Okay. So when it comes to these buildings, although there are tax dollars going toward it, are they returning that tax money in any way? So the naming rights, the revenue from the naming rights, that really just, at least in the case of the Brewers and the Bucks, that just goes straight back to the team.
Yes, that goes back to the team. And in terms of what the taxpayers get, I mean, it's not, they don't really get any direct benefit from the naming rights other than whatever benefit they get indirectly from the facility.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure you heard this as you were reporting this story, but a lot of people were very annoyed by the fact that it became Fiserv Forum. They went, well, we just spent all this money. The state spent all this money on this building, and now some company gets to slap their name on it?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of people did feel that way. But again, the owners put up a significant amount of money for it, and obviously the taxpayers put up a huge amount of money also. But comparatively speaking, compared to a lot of deals in other cities, the owners put up a fairly significant amount. So you could argue from both ways. You know, clearly in the case of the other Wisconsin Center District buildings, the Convention Center and the arena, which is now the UWM Panthers Arena, and the auditorium, which is now the Miller High Life Theater, in those cases, the revenue is going directly to the district, which is a tax-supported entity.
Okay. So the Wisconsin Center, of course, is now just called the Wisconsin Center. But part of what your article does is it goes through a number of these publicly owned buildings and kind of tracks, you know, what their name was and what it is now. So what was the Wisconsin Center before it had its current name, the Wisconsin Center?
Right. So the Wisconsin Center was built to replace the old Convention Center. And they sold the naming rights right at the beginning. And Milwaukee was the first, actually, in the nation to sell naming rights for a convention center. People had sold naming rights for theaters and arts facilities and so forth before. Milwaukee was the first to sell the naming rights for a convention center. And they sold it to what was then Midwest Express Airlines, which was our hometown airline. And things changed because of the nature of the airline business. First, Midwest Express changed its name from Midwest Express to just Midwest. And that created a name change for the convention center. And then after that, Midwest Express was sold to Republic Airlines, which merged it with Frontier Airlines. And then it became the Frontier Center. And then Frontier fell on hard times, and they could not fulfill the last year of their deal. And so Delta picked up the last year of that deal. It became the Delta Center. Delta chose not to renew, and the Wisconsin Center District could not find another naming rights sponsor right away. And so for now, it is just back to being the it's just the Wisconsin Center.
It went through so many name changes, so many complicated name changes. But what I think is interesting about that, just to begin with, is that an airline would be supporting a convention center. Now, what did their deal look like? What did naming rights mean for them?
So for them, clearly, for the airline, what this meant was an opportunity to put their name on a facility that people would be coming to, specifically coming to Milwaukee to attend conventions at. And so they had that sort of official sponsorship. I don't know whether they were the official sponsor, official airline of conventions or whatever, but they had that image in any event. And then the district also got out of that, they got some airline tickets They got $750,000 in airline tickets for their staff's use in, you know, in their business, in promoting conventions and so forth. So it kind of worked both ways.
Miller Park, I think, is a very prominent example, and one that, of course, a lot of people are talking about right now because it's about to change names. And I think it's obvious what Miller would get from naming a ballpark. Obviously, you can get a lot of beer at Miller Park. Mm-hmm. But, you know, American Family Insurance, that to me is a little bit less of a direct line.
Yes, absolutely. It is not connected directly to baseball. However, it's a major Wisconsin company, and it is a consumer-facing company. They're selling their insurance, their auto insurance, and their home insurance to Wisconsin people. And so this puts their name out there. And so this is part of their strategy. And at the same time that they're doing this, you're also seeing their name at Summerfest on what had been the Marcus Amphitheater, is now the American Family Amphitheater, the main stage. You're seeing their name on the 4th of July fireworks. And this is at the same time that they're expanding their Milwaukee presence physically with the new building downtown. You find this with companies. It becomes part of their overall marketing strategy and their strategy for how they want to contribute to the community and be seen in the community.
When it comes to the Fiserv form, I had not heard of Fiserv before Fiserv Forum. So for people like me who may not know what Fiserv actually does, what is that company?
So that company is a financial technology company, and they sell and produce software for financial services businesses like banks. So Fiserv, like financial services. And it is an odd choice for this kind of deal, because ordinarily you see more consumer-facing companies, companies that are more interested in getting their name out to the public. But for Fiserv, they obviously did see some value in it. You know, it is a Fortune 500 company, and they apparently made the decision that they want to raise their profile in this very public way.
Yeah, it does seem like something that's a little bit specific. You know, it's something that has a very targeted audience, as opposed to, you know, your average person going into Miller Park is going to go, well, maybe I'll buy a Miller. Or even American Family Insurance, you might go, well, the next time you're planning to get something insured, maybe I'll go with them. Fiserv is a bit more like, oh, I have this very specific need. I'm in a very specific position, and thus we will use their services.
Right. So the average Bucks fan is probably not going to use Fiserv's services. But on the other hand, you know, sports are big business now. We have these luxury boxes where companies entertain clients. And so there is that business aspect also. And, you know, for Fiserv, if they want to be a bigger member of the corporate community, a more prominent member of the corporate community, it may make some strategic sense for them.
Well, and I guess that gets to my final question. When we're talking about all of these people who buy naming rights, are there concrete numbers to say whether or not this is beneficial for a company or beneficial for the organization giving them those rights?
No, not really. There have been some studies that talk about if you equate it to advertising value. And so by those studies, Miller Coors was doing pretty well for its deal with the Brewers for the stadium naming rights. And they were paying $2 million a year. I think some studies showed that they were getting significantly more than $2 million a year worth of advertising exposure. So in some cases like that, it's worth their while.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
Larry Sandler is a Wisconsin writer whose work can be seen in Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in July about his article on naming rights featured in the magazine. You can find a link to it at WUWM.com. Losing a pet is always difficult for the people who love them. But it can be even more difficult for the pets who are left behind, as writer J.F. Reardon learned when her dog Reggie passed away. She tells us about it in her essay, Pete loses his wingman.
Pete woke up this morning an only dog. He's an animal with odd pockets of timidity and has depended on Reggie's cheerful steadiness for inspiration to leave the warmth of the house. Normally, when we get up in the still dark morning, both dogs rush out together. But this morning, Pete wouldn't go. He doesn't like the wind, and he doesn't like the rain. I put on his coat and told him there were squirrels. He wouldn't go. There were no squirrels. Pete isn't stupid, and Reggie wasn't there to encourage him. We had a rough night last night. Our kind vet and one of his techs came to the house while Pete was locked away upstairs with a very nice bone. We held Reggie and told him we loved him and used something I learned from the late Barbara Woodhouse, an old-school British dog trainer whose advice was of mixed value, but who said that the phrase, "What a good dog," had an electrifying effect on dog morale. It was a term with meaning for Reggie, and we said it repeatedly, along with other endearments that are embarrassing for me to admit, but which Reggie seemed to like. He passed into a deep sleep and was gone. They carried him away. We cried. Pete wouldn't come down. Pete is our rescue dog, part whippet, maybe, part pointer, maybe, part lab, maybe. It's a lot of maybe. We call him an Indiana spotted dog because he came from a kill shelter in Indiana. We were told that he was abused, but he's never said anything about it. His disposition is a curious mix of Eeyore and Eddie Haskell, and he's extremely skillful at gaining love, even from strangers. But his courage, and he actually has a great deal, has always been supplemented by the knowledge that he had a larger, eager comrade who was never as fast, but always right behind him. Anyway, in the end, we went up and sat on the bed with Pete so he wouldn't be alone. This morning will be the first of many adjustments for Pete. All the bones that are scattered around the yard are his now. He gets both the squeaky squirrel toy and the squeaky frog. There will be no one to steal the thrown tennis ball from. The ball will be for him. He doesn't have to nudge his nose in while someone else is being loved. He gets all the love to himself. He gets both windows when we go for a ride. He won't have to hang around veterinarian waiting rooms to offer moral support. And the 2 months of gourmet foods, the sautéed chicken livers, the chicken breasts, the raw beef, the Italian sausage, will suddenly cease. It will be back to health food, which is boring, as we all know, but important if you have a future. We did the right thing. It was hard, but it had to be. I found myself thinking of my late father over the long last days and wishing I could have given him an escape from the agony he was forced to endure from this very same disease. Thank you to all of you who sent us so many words of kindness and support. You can never know how much it meant to us. Pete can't write a thank you. But I think he would if he could. Maybe.
Wisconsin writer J.F. Reardon's latest book is a series of essays called Reflections on a Life in Exile. Reardon read her piece titled Pete Loses His Wingman, and you can listen to more of her essays at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we travel to a galaxy far, far away and examine the philosophy of Star Wars. Like Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. While hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side, philosophy and the need to understand our personal journeys in the world has always been a human need, even for centuries, from the Odyssey to Beowulf. While the Star Wars films take place a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the great epic has deep philosophical themes that we find in literature, mythology, history, and religions all around the world. There's good versus evil, finding balance, enlightenment, and much more that is presented to us through the Force, the Skywalkers, and many other elements that has filled 9 movies worth of heroics, and then some. Mark Peterson is a philosophy professor at UW-Milwaukee's College of General Studies, where he co-teaches a course on superheroes and mythology. He joins me now to geek out about all things like the hero's journey and other influences in Star Wars, and begins by explaining how fictional superheroes can measure up to deep philosophical questions.
The actual structure of the course is an application of semiotic theory to unpacking whether or not metaphorical, mythical, and religious discourse makes sense. If we called the course that, nobody would ever sign up for it.
So the official course name is?
I think it's just called Superheroes and Mythology.
Excellent. All right. So let's get into the semiotic theory. What is that about?
Oh, so semiotic theory is one of the most abused terms in the academic universe. But the simple version of it is it lets us kind of work out when words or pictures or images accurately point at the things they're pointing at. And so, for instance, and making a distinction between the sign itself and the thing it's pointing at. This is what all metaphors do, of course, is they point beyond themselves to something else. So I was thinking about just driving in here today. So if I said to you, for instance, can you go down and find Wisconsin Avenue? And then you went out for a few minutes and you come back and you're carrying the sign off the post out there that says Wisconsin Avenue. You could hand it to me and go, here it is.
Sure.
And I would say, well, that's technically just the sign of Wisconsin Avenue. And you could still say, well, it says Wisconsin Avenue right on there.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, the sign points at Wisconsin Avenue, and it's sort of finding those distinctions that matter. So, for instance, if you haven't ever experienced anything and you have a metaphor that points toward that experience, for instance, if you've never been in love, all the sort of, you know, candy, roses with thorns on them and so on, you don't know why those are metaphors for love if you haven't been in love. But once you've been in love, the rose makes sense with both the thorns and the flower.
And the beauty, yeah.
So semiotics is just a set of, it's kind of a toolbox, a philosophical toolbox that lets you figure out when metaphors are actually working properly. One of the reasons this plugs immediately back into Star Wars is the current hubbub about the final movie.
Yes, episode 9.
In the series.
Which I admit I watched again last night.
Yeah, I only saw it the one time. And I have to tell you, I think they screwed it up.
Okay.
So I'm in that camp.
Sure.
But now everybody's having the argument about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, on what basis are we going to decide?
Yeah, what is correct, what is wrong, what's the proper ending? Exactly.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And so there are ways we can sort of figure out what that might be. And if you just listen to if we were just to take a sample of all of the insane forums on Reddit, where every once in a while I'm brave enough to dip my toes, everybody has their own idea about what that pattern ought to be, right? And they typically focus on just on like the little pieces. There will be spoiler alerts at the beginning of this.
Yes, that's all right. Spoiler alert now. Tune out if you haven't watched it.
The relationship between Finn and Poe, for instance, that was just screaming for more work.
Definitely. And the actors have said they wanted to do more with it as well.
There were little moments, even in the film, that they snuck it in that was really awesome. And I was really looking forward to seeing what was going to go on with Finn and Rosie.
Yeah.
Frankly, that was like, I thought, what a great subplot. And then they just let it.
Yeah, Rose's story was just, you know. And
disappear.
Then sometimes we got to keep in mind that sometimes it comes down to editing. Sometimes it comes down to what can we fit. So there's lots of.
The rumors I've heard on this is that it was kind of a rush job and that somehow the studio established the release date prior to actually having, you know, the final edit. Yeah. So they had to kind of rush it. Looks patched together. And that's not even my main complaint. I'm going to go back to the patterns and the plot trajectories and why some of those are more appealing to us than others, for instance. And this is the case with the Star Wars films. So what is it that makes these films relatable? And it's the plot trajectories and the characterizations, for instance, the characters. And why are they relatable to us, right? And this is all kind of obvious when you say it out loud, but the reason is because we can find pieces of ourselves in the characters. And some of us all want to be Han Solo. And some of us want to be Princess Leia, and some of us want to be Luke, and so on, you know. And what is it that makes those plot lines identifiable to us? And in this case, this is what we talk about in the class, for instance. This brings us back to Joseph Campbell and his influence on George Lucas in the original creation of the project. And so Joseph Campbell, of course, wrote a famous book back in the late 40s called Hero with a Thousand Faces. He expanded on this as he got through the 50s and 60s. He did this whole Masks of God series, which if you ever get a chance to wander through that sucker, it's going to take you a few years to crawl through it. But I found it worthwhile back in the ancient days. But Campbell identified what he found to be a pattern that shows up in most of Western mythology.
A hero's journey of sorts.
The hero's journey, and mm-hmm. exactly that. And what we do know is that Lucas read this book and mirrored those first three films, at least, on the hero's journey directly out of Campbell's analysis of that journey. And so we find it explicit in Luke. And so one of my guesses, even back when I saw the first one, that there's something about this storyline that we find relatable because we see our own lives in this trajectory.
So Luke is a reluctant person called to service by something bigger than himself. And of course, it gets into all these obstacles. We see it in Homer's Odyssey or even Beowulf, you know, constant similar journeys throughout literature that we are called to. And it seems like our repeated philosophical question throughout most of human existence is, you know, what does it mean to be good? And in Star Wars, there's this idea of balance and good and evil in the Jedi versus the Sith. But there's also an included political and moral philosophy in the nature of good and evil and the Force in this.
Oh, boy, the water gets deep really quickly when you start to drag it to the political stuff. I think what I'd say right off the top, though, about the philosophical and religious sort of background radiation that infects the Force and the Jedis and what would goodness mean in a case like that? And this is a really dangerous idea, by the way.
Because they're supposedly supposed to be more neutral versus the hero's journey. It kind of resembles like, oh, this is what's good, the right thing to do.
Exactly right. Yeah. And so for the hero's journey, what it means to be good is to fulfill yourself as a human being and to live a completely authentic life. And so the hero's journey maps, this is one way to think about what Campbell's insight was to map the hero's journey in our cultural mythology. So in a case of like Luke's trajectory, right, the hero's journey, these are psychological obstacles we all come to as we travel towards our own authentic lives. Now, this is good existential stuff too.
Definitely. Yeah.
But it's sort of true. And so in the pattern that Campbell found, the broad pattern for the hero's journey is summarized in three parts, separations, initiations, and then returns. And so as you said, right, Luke is a reluctant hero. So the hero can start off in all sorts of different ways. Some people never make it out of their parents' basements, right? Some people have to be dragged kicking and screaming and thrown out on the journey. My mother reminded me of this, by the way. I saw her last week, and she was saying, yeah, do you remember when I had to threaten to drive you to college because you were dragging your feet? It's like, oh, yeah, I remember. So I packed up and got over there on my own. So I was sort of kicked out of the house to get on my journey. But it's all different for different people. And of course, Luke has no interest in doing any of this. And then all hell breaks loose, and he is just simply thrown headlong into it. So this is the first part of separation. The other sort of key component in that first part of the journey are these threshold guardians. And this is a really fruitful idea for all of us. It's like there's all sorts of things that keep us from being who we actually are, right? And in Luke's case, it shows up nicely in the bar scene at the very beginning where they're negotiating with Solo, you know.
Or even before with the power converters.
I suspect that's right. And it's like, we need to get those online, kiddo. I'm sorry about that. you've completely established your street cred here.
Thank you.
And there's all sorts of things that keep us from doing it. And you know, it's just, there's a lot to overcome.
Yes.
But so anyway, so yeah, separation and these initiations take the same form they do for all of us. It's one of the difficulties with Campbell's work is that he wrote this in 1948. And the gender sort of structures that show up there are specific to 1948. And so when I do this in class, we have this, it's kind of a useful opportunity to talk about this because for Campbell, of course, the hero's always male because that was true throughout most of Western.
Most, yeah.
But certainly not all. There's some very interesting wrinkles to this. And the best one, my favorite example, is that the earliest cultural mythology that we have in text form, cuneiform tablets, is the Inanna cycle of myths, in which you have a goddess who becomes a heroine who goes on a quest to recapture her birthright from her evil uncle. It's like, interesting. And so that was sort of, to me, one of the best parts about having Rey show up in the last three. It's like, this is good. We needed a female character to balance this out and make it accessible.
Despite the many objections of all the fanboys out there. But yeah, they gotta like get you said, I think it was a good thing.
They got to get over themselves.
They
you know, men need more women heroes in the world. It's really much easier on all of us.
Everyone needs more female heroes. You mentioned some Buddhist backstories and themes. And I think the Jedi kind of most align with, if we're looking out of their global religions, philosophy, traditions, is the Buddhist themes and practices. Not idea, but imagery, the whole idea of nirvana for Jedi, it's reaching peace, passiveness in your mind to open yourself to other powers. They kind of live, you know, desireless living. You know, they give up despite the fact they're taken away as a young child without the choice necessarily to become a Jedi. But kind of monks in a way. They don't marry. They don't want for material things. It's all about the practice. So with Buddhist practices, are there other also global religions and things that you see touched upon
For most of us in North America who grew up separated from most of the other world religions, we can see the disagreeable effects of being exposed to those now because they challenge our worldview. I think I would Buddhism is the easiest access port for a lot of that, but I think I'm going to gloss it and go with Taoism here. Because with Taoism, you have the whole yin-yang thing. You have the dark and the light intertwined at every moment.
Light side, dark side, yes.
And the balance that you have to maintain between them. And it's that balance, that making your position correct in Taoism, that establishes you as a good person.
The constant battle of bringing balance to the force throughout whole thing.
And that runs all the way through. Yeah. And I'm a long time – I took up Tai Chi, for instance, when I was in graduate school. Now, usually I'd say I did that to keep from killing my supervisor, which it worked. it was such an intense experience that I needed this kind of calming release. Tai Chi makes use of all of these same kind of Taoist principles, for instance. And so it's very easy for a lot of us who work in that stuff to equate the force with your chi. And, you know, he puts the mask, you know, remember Alec Guinness, try it with the shield down,
yes.
Luke, you know, and Luke is able to feel the movement of the force and so on. And so my best sense is that really belongs to Taoism and to the Qi. The Buddhists, it's really interesting how this shows up in Asian religions. And certainly if you go to China, there's always been this kind of synthesis of Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, all three together. And I think that's what
I think that's very important because the whole concept of the Jedi way, you hear lines Anakin Skywalker says, it's not the Jedi way, you know, to kill or be violent. Yet that's part of a lot of the trials or things that they're believed need to happen to bring balance. And Luke ultimately kind of rejects the Jedi dogma. He isolates himself on an island. So what do you think of the whole, like you said, what you think is the best balance is being true to yourself, whereas you see the battle between Sith, Jedi, the Sith thinking the Force is best used this way, Jedi think it's this way, but then the Jedi realizing, like, but our way is flawed, too.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, too, because I thought this was really important. And I went around and around with a few of my Star Wars freak friends about this, the second to the last film, right, where Luke has, like, just isolated himself, and they did that great opening shot in number 8 where she walks up and hands him the lightsaber with anticipation. He takes it and he just throws it over his shoulder. The beauty of this is that that also fits into the hero's journey in an actually a beautiful way. Like, see, what happens was Luke became a Jedi, right? And he starts the whole thing and then Kylo Ren falls off the trail and becomes, you know, goes to the dark side. And then blows the place up, and Luke thinks, well, screw this, man. I'm just not good enough to do this. One of the typical things that happens in the hero's journey, and this is part of the beauty of it but also the tragedy, is that not everybody makes it. You know, this is true for all of us when we try to find our authentic whatever we are, right? And it's like we don't know ahead of time, see? But there's something in us that seems to, right, that moves us toward it. And we can fail in that all the time. You just get through life as best you can. And it would be great if you could do those things. But here's the deal. It's like once you get the Holy Grail, this is in Campbell's point, to really be a real hero, you got to bring that home, right? So Ulysses has to get home. Jason has to get home with the golden fleece, right? And Parsifal screws this up in the Parsifal story, of course, when he goes off on the Grail quest. He finds the damn thing right away and then screws it up. And they throw him out of the castle, and that's that. So then he spends the next, you know, years looking for the thing again. Then he gets it right, but then he brings it back and saves the world. So, okay, so number eight, Luke has rejected this and says, screw all of this. And I swear to God, I thought at this point, and then, you know, Rey takes off, and Luke is left on the island. And I thought, oh, don't do this to me. Don't screw it up now. We're so close to the end. And Luke is going up to burn the tree down. I'm thinking, oh, don't. And then suddenly, oh, God, spoiler, Yoda shows up. And it's like, we're going to be okay.
Yes, yes.
And then Yoda gives him, hits him on the head again. Miss you, I have, young Skywalker. And Luke gets his stuff put back in proper shape and then actually returns to buy Rey and the rest of the Resistance the opportunity. And then he goes off to his reward.
And then the roles are kind of, Yoda's role is passed on to Luke in this last one.
Exactly as it should be.
Yeah.
Exactly as it should be. A little weird gloss on that, by the way, because this is something I've been thinking about for a few years now. I kept thinking, it's like, so where am I on this spectrum? Where am I on this spectrum? Have I made it to Obi-Wan yet? And it's like, I think I've made it to Obi-Wan now. I'm kind of okay with this. Maybe a young, you know, slightly reckless Obi-Wan, but I think I've made it from Luke to Obi-Wan. Most of Western mythology is structured around the transition from being Luke, right, to becoming Obi-Wan, right? And nobody ever tells you how you go from Obi-Wan to Yoda. And there was this very interesting, this is a little geeky, but there's a really interesting throwaway line at the end of number three where Yoda sends Obi-Wan out to keep an eye on Luke for the next 10 or 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, exercises I will give you. And I think that's it. It's usually, there's all sorts of stuff you have to go through to get to Obi-Wan. But after you're Obi-Wan, now you have to spend the next 20 years just practicing everything you already know. And if you're really paying attention to it and you stay balanced, then you get to be Yoda.
Well, and hopefully we're going to find that out in Ewan McGregor's reprisal of the role. And they're making Obi-Wan.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. So
let's hope so.
We'll probably have more philosophy things to talk about with that.
There's always something more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could very easily spend the whole hour of Lake Fact and then some talking Star Wars philosophy with you. But Mark Peterson, thanks for coming in and sharing your knowledge. And may the Force be with you.
May the Force be with all of us.
Mark Peterson is a philosophy professor at UW-Milwaukee's College of General Studies, where he co-teaches a course on superheroes and mythology. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Like Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.